and officials of Portugal, thank you for all that you came the long way to Portugal, to Lisboa. It's Lisboa, I will tell you a secret. Lisboa is my late love in my life. And when I heard that Luis made it possible that we can come to Lisbon, I was double and more happy to be back in Lisbon, in this amazing city, and also in the convento. So I want also thank to the representatives of the Portuguese Parliament, my thanks that we can stay in your parliament, in your city. And it's a special honor for us to be here. And thanks again. Now the good news, dear colleagues, we have the quorum. So I have not to close the meeting and not reopen. So we are free also to change the agenda if we need. Can we adopt the revised agenda which you have in your files? Yes, so I declare it as adopted. Now, Mr. Eduardo Ferro Rodriguez, President of the Assembly of the Republic of Portugal, and Mrs. Ana Catarina Mendes, the chairperson of the Portuguese delegation to our Assembly. Thank you again. And that we are here. And Mr. President Rodriguez, I wanted to ask to say some words to our committee. You will take from there. Yes, okay. You are the boss in this building, so you can go everywhere.
Senhor Secretário de Estado das Autarquias Locais, Dr. Carlos Miguel, Senhor Presidente da Comissão de Assuntos Sociais, Saúde e Desenvolvimento Sustentável da Assembleia Parlamentar do Conselho da Europa, Deputado Stefan Skanach, na Áustria, Senhora Presidente da Delegação Portuguesa à Assembleia Parlamentar do Conselho da Europa, Deputada Ana Catarina Mendes, Senhor Vice-Presidente da Comissão, Deputado Luís Leite Ramos, Senhor Secretário-Geral do Congresso dos Poderes Locais e Regionais do Conselho da Europa, Sr. André Schiffer, Sra. Antiga Presidente da Assembleia Parlamentar do Conselho da Europa, Deputada Stella Kyriakides, Minhas Senhoras e Meus Senhores. Sejam bem-vindos ao Parlamento Português, à nossa Assembleia da República. É com grande satisfação que a Assembleia da República recebe a Comissão de Questões Sociais, Saúde e Desenvolvimento Sustentável da Assembleia Parlamentar do Conselho da Europa. E é com grande satisfação que vejo aqui a minha colega e amiga, Ana Catarina Mendes, que desempenha hoje a função que eu desempenhei, já lá vão 13 anos. O acervo normativo do Conselho da Europa é hoje uma parte integrante da atividade das nossas instituições e da vida dos nossos cidadãos. A adesão de Portugal em 1976 constituiu o primeiro grande marco da consolidação do processo democrático iniciado em abril de 1974, depois de 48 anos de regime ditatorial em Portugal. Portugal e, em particular, a Assembleia da República celebram em 2018 os 70 anos da Declaração Universal dos Direitos Humanos e os 40 anos da adesão à Convenção Europeia dos Direitos Humanos. Há 40 anos, pela mão do então Ministro Mendes Ferreira e do então Primeiro-Ministro Mário Soares, a jovem democracia portuguesa entrava de pleno direito na Comunidade Europeia das Nações, que procuram a liberdade e a justiça. 40 anos depois, podemos dizer que o acervo normativo do Conselho da Europa é hoje uma parte integrante da atividade das nossas instituições e da vida dos nossos cidadãos. Passadas 4 décadas, sobre aquele passo transformativo, o Conselho da Europa beneficia do mais alto respeito e estima em Portugal. Orgulhamos-nos também de ser Lisboa a sede do Centro Norte-Sul, cujo contributo efetivo para o diálogo intercultural e para a cidadania democrática não é demais recordar. É realmente singular a mais-valia do Conselho da Europa, os seus pilares, os direitos humanos, a democracia e o Estado de Direito são a base pelas quais se deve nortear o modo de ser e de estar dos seus membros. Não deixam também de ser desafios atuais, como é igualmente o seu propósito, realizar uma união mais estreita entre os seus membros, a fim de salvaguardar e promover os ideais e os princípios que são o seu património comum e favorecer o seu progresso económico e social. Vivemos tempos bem diferentes dos que a Europa viveu a quando da celebração da Declaração Universal, assinada em Paris, fazem 2019 70 anos, e 2 anos mais tarde é quando da assinatura da Convenção Europeia dos Direitos Humanos. Muito mudou a nível político, económico, cultural, científico e da sociedade. Sem perder o rumo dos nossos valores e princípios, as novas realidades e desafios exigem que tenhamos a capacidade de traçar perspectivas e de dar respostas que preservem a razão de ser da organização e sejam também promotoras da paz, da prosperidade e do desenvolvimento humano. A paz mundial e a segurança internacional exigem que retomemos o caminho do direito internacional, do multilateralismo, da promoção dos direitos humanos e da democracia. A vossa agenda é a demonstração de que o Conselho da Europa mantém a ambição dos seus fundadores. Muito do que nos junta aqui hoje em Lisboa tem sido matéria de debate intenso na Assembleia da República. A descentralização, a procriação assistida e a saúde pública, o desenvolvimento sustentável, a energia e o ambiente. São temas horizontais que excedem os limites do conjuntural e que têm um impacto profundo nas nossas sociedades. São naturalmente temas em que a pluralidade de posições espelha a pluralidade própria da vida democrática. Da minha parte e da Assembleia da República, faço votos para que esta sessão em Lisboa seja produtiva e que o vosso debate se traduza mais tarde em orientações e recomendações que nos ajudem a tornar melhores, mais justas, livres e inclusivas as nossas sociedades neste momento tão importante para a Europa. Muito obrigado.
Dear Speaker, thank you for those words, because you put the finger exactly on the point what we need and what we have to save for the future in Europe and also for our institution. Thank you very, very much. It was very impressive to listen to you. And now I want to ask Ana Mendes to take the floor.
Substituir nestas funções de Presidente da Delegação Portuguesa um tão brilhante Presidente da Assembleia da República que temos hoje, o Dr. Ferro Rodrigues, meu querido amigo. Mas eu queria começar esta nossa sessão por saudar a iniciativa da Comissão dos Assuntos Sociais, Saúde e Desenvolvimento, por reunirem aqui no Parlamento Português, e não posso deixar de dar uma palavra de estímulo e de apreço ao deputado Leite Ramos, que tem sido inexcedível no seu trabalho nesta Comissão e na Assembleia Parlamentar do Conselho da Europa. Não sendo nós do mesmo partido e não partilhando a visão, em muitos temas, a mesma visão da sociedade, a verdade é que nos unem os valores do Conselho da Europa e, por isso mesmo, uma palavra para que a delegação portuguesa continue na Assembleia Parlamentar a defender sempre, na defesa radical sempre, da democracia e dos direitos humanos. Como Presidente da Delegação Portuguesa à Assembleia Parlamentar do Conselho da Europa, quero dar as boas-vindas a todos os colegas e faço verdadeiramente votos para que esta reflexão destes dois dias, com tantos peritos e com tantos membros do Governo que se associam a esta Comissão, possam ser de intensa reflexão, discussão, mas mais do que isso, que possam ser de ação para o futuro. Como disse o Presidente da Assembleia da República há instantes, vivemos tempos de rápidas mudanças no mundo e na Europa. E em muitos Estados-membros do Conselho da Europa, o individualismo, o nacionalismo e o egoísmo estão a sobrepor-se à solidariedade e ao respeito pelos direitos humanos. O nosso papel enquanto deputados à Assembleia Parlamentar do Conselho da Europa é o de agir para que o projeto comum de estabilidade política, de paz, de melhoria das condições de vida dos nossos cidadãos, de justiça social e do reforço da democracia continue viva e cresça. Perante as ameaças, que não cedamos ao medo, mas que a nossa ação seja de valorização dos nossos valores sempre, numa democracia mais forte. E, caros colegas, é neste pressuposto que se inclui a agenda desta Comissão. Os temas são da maior relevância política, desde o papel dos Parlamentos Nacionais no processo de descentralização, e permitam-me que aqui vos diga, tendo nós celebrado no dia 1 de setembro os 30 anos do início da vigência na Ordem Internacional da Carta Europeia da Autonomia Local, tendo nós presente nesta sessão o Sr. Secretário de Estado das Autarquias Locais, Portugal, nesta legislatura, imprimiu como uma das suas prioridades a descentralização no poder local, por uma questão de maior proximidade aos nossos cidadãos, mas de maior democracia e de maior participação dos nossos cidadãos no poder e nas instituições de poder. E por isso mesmo, esta é uma reforma para nós absolutamente essencial. Costumamos dizer que o impacto da descentralização na gestão dos recursos existentes significa um euro investido no poder local corresponde a 3 euros investidos pela administração central, o que implica também para nós olhar para o processo de descentralização como uma maior racionalidade da gestão dos recursos públicos e, por isso mesmo, uma aposta desta nossa legislatura. Mas, se é verdade que este é um dos temas essenciais e que será aqui debatido, não podemos também esquecer a importância dos Parlamentos Nacionais nos Objetivos do Desenvolvimento Sustentável das Nações Unidas. E ainda temos que correr muito para os cumprir. E por isso destaco aqui, porque também está na vossa agenda, as necessidades de saúde nos adolescentes na Europa, e deixava uma nota para dizer: Portugal é um dos 5 países com mais obesos na adolescência. Isto trará inevitavelmente problemas no futuro, e é por isso mesmo que é preciso prevenir hoje, no presente, para conseguirmos alcançar melhores resultados na saúde pública e, sobretudo, na saúde infantil nos próximos anos, mas assegurar também o combate à pobreza e assegurar a educação inclusiva e a formação ao longo da vida são prioridades que estão também na vossa agenda. Ter a segurança e a proteção nucleares, eu julgo que é um dos debates mais importantes dos últimos tempos. Nós não esquecemos nem o impacto dos acidentes nucleares como sendo transnacionais. Não esquecemos o que aconteceu em Fukushima em 2011, mas também não esquecemos o que aconteceu em Chernobyl em 1986. E por isso não podemos olhar para aquilo que são ameaças dos Estados Unidos ou da Coreia do Norte como ameaças à segurança na Europa, e por isso a Europa também aqui tem que ter uma palavra mais forte e uma ação mais forte. No trabalho e no ambiente, os novos desafios apresentados pela rápida alteração de paradigma laboral a propósito da revolução tecnológica em curso provocará seguramente o desaparecimento de muitas das profissões tal qual as conhecemos hoje, mas provocará também o nascimento de novas profissões que ainda hoje as desconhecemos. E por isso é preciso ter uma palavra para com as pessoas que ficarão no meio termo por inadaptação aos novos empregos, ou mesmo as que não terão a possibilidade de efetuar a reconversão, mas não olhar para a sociedade digital como uma fatalidade, mas como uma oportunidade de maior aposta na nossa formação. Por isso mesmo, responder ao desafio da preparação da sociedade para as profissões de hoje inexistentes e desconhecidas é uma ambição que passa também pelo Conselho da Europa e por esta Comissão. Queria terminar, meus caros colegas, dizendo-lhes que a Europa precisa de uma política comum que garanta a nossa segurança, não esquecendo também aqui os temas da procriação medicamente assistida, que nos convoca para a reflexão dos equilíbrios a ter entre os direitos dos pais, dos doadores e das crianças, e este é um tema absolutamente central também nos dias de hoje na sociedade portuguesa. Temas que, de tão relevantes, contarão, repito, com o contributo de vários especialistas portugueses e membros do Governo, e estou certa de que a reflexão será profícua ao final destes dois dias. Desejo, por isso, um bom trabalho a todos na construção de uma sociedade mais justa, no respeito pelos valores do Conselho da Europa. Muito obrigada.
Dear Mrs. Mendes, thank you also for your words, and also that you made a link to environment questions and questions in the time of climate change, which will decide about our future, the future of Europe, the future of the world. And I, in the subcommittee before, I said my thanks to Luis Leite Ramos. And now I will add this, my thanks to him. He is my deputy chair of this committee, and he is really a great person. We are not in the same political group, but this has nothing to do if to show somebody respect and and to accept the work of another person. And this is something what we should, in that way we should go ahead. And Luis, thank you again. Thank you that you are the vice chair of this committee and for all your initiatives. Thank you very, very much. And I want to tell you, in behalf of the Portuguese delegation, that the mayor of the city of Cascais, Mr. Carlos Carreiras, invite us this night for an official dinner. Cascais is an amazing place, and I asked before, there are discussion, refugees welcome. In Cascais, there was a period of time where kings was welcome, and I think at the same time, there was 7 to 9 kings which lived in Cascais in exile from different parts of Europe. That is something very, very interesting, and you will see it's an amazing place, Cascais. The transfers will be organized from your hotels. Nobody from here. Oh, we are going directly from here, and they bring us back to the hotel. Nobody will be left anywhere. So thanks again for the opening, and we have to go on. So thank you very, very much. Wir bleiben jetzt einfach sitzen. Now I come to topic 3, the minutes from our last meeting. Uh, But before we are going on, we have requests from external parties to attend our meeting in this week for the topic 7 and 8 of our agenda. It is following NGOs ask for that. It's Mr. José Pedro Ramos Asensao from the Federation of Catholic Family Association in Europe. Since point 7 on the agenda is a public hearing, and I want to make the proposal that he can admit, but we discussed the palliative care report, point 8, in different meetings so much that I not accept the request for point 8. So the decision, what I propose is that Mr. José Pedro Ramos Asensio from the Federation of Catholic Families can participate in point 7, but not point 8. Can we approve in that way? Thank you. Can we also approve the 12 minutes from our last meetings in the June session in Strasbourg? I declare them as approved. Now, dear colleagues, we have to change now a little bit the agenda. Eleni is a little bit under pressure and in time. And we don't want that she will miss her fly. And therefore, I want to ask Doreen that we start with the top five, addressing the health need of adolescents in Europe first. And that Eleni is able to get her plane back home. Can you agree into that? If yes, I give the floor immediately to Baroness Macy.
Good morning. You want me to speak, yes?
Yes.
A quick comment. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. There should be 4 slides, which I want to look at very quickly. Just to say that this topic, addressing the health needs of adolescents, is obviously a very vast topic. It could be the subject of about at least 10 books. We haven't got 10 books, we've got one report. So what the report will seek to do is to just give a snapshot of adolescence, some of the issues affecting adolescence, and look at some of the good practice in dealing with those issues. The first thing we will do is we define adolescence, age between 10 and 19, and we want very much to look upon adolescence not as just a problem. We don't want to demonise adolescents. We want them to be productive members of society and have active health in adolescence, but also health which will carry on into their adulthood. So we don't want to demonise, we want to be productive about adolescent health. And the second thing I would say is that we want the subject to be approached from a life course approach, which means that each phase of life has its own issues. Adolescents have their own issues, but those issues should be linked together in a kind of seamless line. The life course approach also seeks to involve groups in each life phase to resolve their own issues and contribute to improving their own issues. And also what we want to do is to focus on how services should be coordinated across the board, education, health and so on, coordinate the services to provide a better service for adolescents in this case. We also talk a bit about brain development because there's a lot of new research on brain development in adolescents, and we want to understand how adolescent activity, for example, risk-taking, is influenced by changes in the brain during adolescence. So we want a snapshot of that and then try to suggest some solutions. I'm just going to talk through this. The slides are not there, as you can see, so I'm just going to talk through it. Okay. And I think Elaine is trying to sort it out.
Slides are not there, no.
There are, of course, lots of influence in adolescence, influence on all of us as regards health. And those influences are very strong. For example, poverty. For example, family, friends, gender, sexuality, and so on. So we need to take account of the influences as well as just the person being in the centre of it. The principles of the report, there are four principles of the report, that adolescence is a key stage of life and needs attention and investment. We show that adolescent health is very badly, not badly, but under-researched. A lot on preschool, primary education, and childhood, a lot on age, but not enough on adolescence. We put forward the point that adolescents should be involved in developing strategies to help themselves, and that inequalities in health is a supremely important issue and must be addressed. I also feel that international recommendations, of which there are several, from World Health Organization, Council of Europe, UNICEF, and so on, those international recommendations are all very well, but they need to be implemented at national and local levels in order to be effective and to be able to be evaluated. And my final slide, which is not there.
You've gone through it.
I'm not going through this again. Here we are. The areas that I shall cover in more depth are three issues which are important for adolescents now and in the future, in all countries of Europe, I think, in fact, all countries of the world, probably. One is mental health, one is sexual health, and one is obesity. Interesting that our colleague from Portugal mentioned this as a problem in Portugal. So I look into those in some depth, and also look at the cost-effectiveness of interventions. So it's, what is the issue? How much does it cost for an intervention to that issue, to help resolve the issue? And how much would you have spent anyway? So it's cost-effectiveness. I think it's increasingly important for all of us to be able to show that our interventions are effective with costs. So there is something on that as well. Please, if you have, colleagues, if you have any examples, good examples of good practice in any of those areas, tell me, and I will try to incorporate it even at this quite late stage into the report somehow. We do have appendices in the report, and they are, one is on parental involvement, one is on involving young people, one is on policies from various countries. I shall be going to Sweden at the end of September and look forward to that, to develop that further, looking at policies which are effective in adolescence. I'm going to pass over now to Eleni. Shall I talk through that?
Did you want to go at all through the...
One minute. Are there any questions to Doreen? If not... Allow me, Eleni, that I give you now the floor. Oh, no, I have one question, please.
Thank you, Mrs. Scheer. I read the report, Doreen, and it was quite interesting. I only miss one subject. It's very due to the adolescent at this moment that there is a decreasing amount of experimenting with drugs, not only illegal drugs, but also legal drugs, just bought from internet like Ritalin and so on and so on. This is not one of the issues you took in the report, so I will ask why you make that choice. Thank you.
There are many issues not in the report. As I say, it's a snapshot. But the issue of drugs, of smoking, of alcohol, of accidents, risk-taking, I've included really as part of the mental health issues. I think that the drug-taking, the risk-taking, alcohol and so on are at least partly because there is some kind of mental health need and not just an addiction. Okay?
Thank you. Now I want to introduce Eleni. Eleni is a clinical psychologist, and she is from the Department for Psychology in the University of Cyprus, is it right? And she gave us a memorandum addressing the health needs of adolescents in Europe. The Secretariat sent it you by mail, so you have it also, I hope, in your files. Then you can read it, and now, Eleni, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to thank the Council of Europe for giving me this opportunity to be here with you today, and I also want to thank the former speaker for handing over his place and letting me not miss my flight. Going on to what we are here to discuss today, addressing the health needs, and I think that relating to the question posed, it needs to be said that we're looking at health in general, not just addiction. And it is an issue. We do understand and we do realize that different countries have different legislation, and we respect that. But I think that the main point of the memorandum is that things need to be taken into context. So you do have the general idea, you do have the European idea and the guidelines, but at the same time you need to apply them in your own national context as you see fit. And this is the main point. So, what do we know? We know, according to the World Health Organization, that adolescence is defined as the age time between 10 and 19, but it has been extended to young people to address the several issues that we will see later on about how things are developed, especially the brain, because recent studies in the last decade or so have shown us that while we believed that the adolescent brain was consolidated by the age of 18 or 20, it seems to continue developing by the age of 24. So it was extended to account for all the changes, both hormonal and brain and societal changes that adolescents need to adapt to. According to a UN report, about 14% of Europe accounts for adolescents. So people from 10 to 19 years old. That's a big number of the population. They tend to be generally healthy, and this was believed so up until recently. Now, when we talk about health, we talk about health in terms of ill health and good health. Yes, they can be generally healthy, but that doesn't mean that they don't have aspects of their health that are not well adjusted. It doesn't mean that they might have some risk factors that we still need to look into, or some issues that are not clinically developed, so they wouldn't be diagnosable from a doctor or a psychologist, for example, or a nurse or a social worker, but they still need to be addressed in order to prevent things from happening later on. Coincidentally, this year, World Mental Health Day in 2018, it's October 10th every year, the topic is young people and mental health in a changing world. The World Health Organization has realized that there are rapid changes that are happening in the world affecting adolescents, and they want to do everything that we can so that we can support them grow up healthy, happy, and resilient. So what we also know is that it is a critical time of development, especially the brain development. We used to think that everything develops by the age of 18. Now we realize, according to scientific data, that that is not true, especially with regards to higher functioning. So that is decision-making, impulse control, and these aspects of behavior, they get consolidated after the age of 14 or 15. There's also physical development spurts. There's the first spurt from 10 to 14, which tends to be the physical changes that we see developing the secondary sexual characteristics. Then we see the 15 to 19, which more so addresses consolidation and the formation of all the habits. And then mental and sexual health, we do know from research worldwide that 75% of mental health disorders present before the age of 24, and actually 50% before the age of 14. This is a big, big, big number, and this is something that we tend to miss a lot. Also, suicidality is going up in numbers. It is the number two reason for deaths in adolescence. Number one is traffic accidents. Also, STDs and STIs have not gone down, even though we have seen a lot of sex education or health education or sexuality education, however it's called in your country, being implemented. And substance abuse and dependence has been pretty consistent. Also, the sociocultural determinants are a lot and very significant, and we usually ignore them when we apply a lot of our prevention efforts or a lot of our intervention efforts. Things like education, access to education, whether somebody's family has an education in their background, access to health care, unhealthy lifestyles, be that media or connectedness and new technologies, levels of physical activity, but also most importantly, and it was something that was mentioned before, addressing poverty and inequality and access to, well, for those youth that really, really do need the services usually doesn't exist. The primary focus for research and data tends to be for the under fives, so children under the age of five, sometimes under the age of 10, but primarily it's under the age of five. So we have a lot of efforts and intervention and prevention efforts that focus on that age group, and that has helped a lot in addressing a lot of issues from developing later on, but we haven't done the second level of prevention, which is needs to be done in adolescence. Current practices, we have a lot of evidence-based practices that work. They are efficient, they are effective, and they are also cost-effective. On a community level, on web, there's a lot of telehealth being developed in recent years, school-based, family-based, and individual therapy if need be. In terms of cost-effectiveness, we do see immediate results and reductions in the costs where and when evidence-based interventions are being implemented. At the same time, a lot of research results or researchers tend to say that we do need to see and assess for longer term to define the longer term effects of the cost effectiveness. So, Benjamin Franklin said, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And this is one of the premises of my report. The World Health Organization postulated that adolescents are the greatest resource for a society to thrive and that we need to invest in them if we're going to have healthy generations. Future action needs to take a life course approach, so we need to safeguard, basically, the investment that is done in childhood, because right now we put a lot of investment, a lot of money, a lot of effort in childhood up until the age of 10 or 12, then we ignore a big chunk of adolescent health, and then we go into adult health, usually addressing things like heart disease, cancer, and all those aspects, and there is a void in the middle that we miss in terms of preventing all those health issues that develop later on. We need to address it from a multicultural or multi-level factors. We need to address all the factors. We can't just address one, so we can't just provide education, for example, or we can't just provide therapy. Efforts need to be based on evidence that things that work. There are a lot of things being implemented, a lot of efforts out there that are presented as efficacious, but they're not necessarily efficacious, and there's plenty of research to show us nowadays what works and what doesn't. It needs to be fit for purpose, so it needs to be data-driven and needs-driven. Each country has their own needs. They have their own priorities. We also need the data, though, to identify those priorities. And a lot of the time, we unfortunately don't have the funding to do the research to identify the needs. So we tend to take guidelines or data at a European level or at an international level and apply them de facto to our situation. So we do need to use the guidelines because they're there to guide us and they're there based on research and experience. But we also need to look at things from a local, regional, and national level. There needs to be a balanced adolescent participation, and I was happy to hear about the the initiative to involve youth in the Council of Europe, because we do need to hear the voices. Adults don't always know best, especially with the changes that we're seeing now and that we don't know. We haven't lived them as adolescents ourselves, so we cannot fully understand what's going on, and at the same time, we need to balance that with the protection that we can provide them as adults to make better choices, to make better friendships, to make better health decisions for themselves. And then efforts need to be coordinated to avoid silos, so to avoid, especially in bigger countries or even smaller countries like my own, it's easy to have different organizations doing the same thing and not knowing each other. Professional training. This is an area that is grossly neglected in professional training, and we need to address that. A lot of the people in professional areas tend to focus also in children under the age of 10 or in adults. There needs to be a strategy for things to be implemented so that there is a policy, so that people, key stakeholders know what they need to follow through on, so that assessment of the efforts needs to be implemented and applied, so that there's a follow through as well, so that we all know, both politicians and stakeholders, that things are moving in the way that we want them to move. So I will end with a quote by UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. To work effectively for and with adolescents, it is essential that we engage with stakeholders across the health, education, employment, governments, and other sectors. We must ensure that the marginalized have access to opportunities and gender discrimination and leverage technology for innovation. And we must do far more to prevent violations of the human rights of adolescents, especially girls. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much, Eleni. And I want to ask you, are there any questions to Eleni? Please.
Obrigada, Sr. Presidente. Eu queria começar por aproveitar esta oportunidade para dar as boas-vindas aos colegas aqui à cidade de Lisboa e a Portugal. Felicitar a relatora, Doreen, pelo seu relatório tão importante e com tanta atualidade, e também felicitar a especialista Eleni Karaine. Acho que é muito importante sublinhar que nos tempos, no atual contexto da era digital, em que os jovens acedem a toda a informação através da internet, dizia eu, é importante sublinhar a importância da educação sexual e que, do meu ponto de vista, deve começar o mais cedo possível, obviamente adequada à faixa etária e ministrada por especialistas. Porque, senão, os jovens têm, com o acesso que têm à internet, podem ter uma visão distorcida, errada, do que deve ser a sexualidade. E, portanto, a não fazerem um bom uso do seu desenvolvimento sexual. Por outro lado, também gostaria de perguntar até que ponto é que os determinantes sociais conduzem também a uma série de desigualdades na saúde. Desde logo no acesso à saúde, mas também no acesso à informação e também eles próprios não estarem preparados, por exemplo, no que diz respeito à alimentação e daí à obesidade, porque não têm um ambiente familiar que seja propício a terem uma alimentação saudável. E, portanto, há aqui, de facto, logo uma desigualdade que resulta do seu contexto socioeconómico. Muito obrigada.
Eleni, I'll
do the first bit. Eleni will do the more difficult one. I should say also that I really working with Eleni on this issue, on these issues, because she's so professional, so thorough, and so pleasant to work with, and that's wonderful. To go back to your question, media, very important issue, becoming more important. There are good aspects of adolescence, obviously, and with younger people, but some of them are dreadful. There's cyberbullying, there's pornography, etc., etc. And I think that one of the things that I do mention in the report is that there should be some restrictions on certain kinds of media for children and adolescents, legally, in countries, and we all have our own issues there. But I think also it's not enough. I think what we should be doing is to help adolescents develop a resilience to pressure and give them information about what is right and what is wrong. I don't mean morally, I mean, in for example, sex. You mentioned sex education. You know, there are some myths around about, and I prefer to call it sexuality education, because sex education has all kinds of connotations about teaching five-year-olds. We do in the UK anyway, maybe you don't, but we do. So I use the term sexuality education. And in sexuality education, I think that young people should learn how to have relationships, friendships at a young age, and then that develops on through the life course into more specific information about sexuality, like contraception. And so they need information, they also need teaching how to say no, how to be resilient to these pressures on them. Over to you.
I would add that while it is great to offer school-based programs, we can't just rely on those. And we need to educate parents and we need to educate society as well. Because before a child enters the school system to start with sexuality education or health education or however you want to call it, it learns from the family. So if the parents don't know, then, and if the parents resist or have their own qualms in terms of discussing these issues, then they won't be able to address them even if the child starts gaining the information at the school level. And this is usually one of the difficulties that we encounter. In terms of numbers and media, it is a big issue. I mean, for example, and it is such a big issue that in the new ICD-10, that just came out, a new addiction has been added in terms of media and networking. And it's worrying to hear when you see statistics like 66% of adolescents have sexted in Spain. It's recent data that I just found out last week. And 12% of them were forced to do it. So they do need the support. At the same time, what has come out of research is that a lot of the times they lack the literacy. So they lack the knowledge of where to get the information. And even if it is available at their school, they may not feel comfortable to go to the school counselor and knock on the door and say, hello, here I am, I have an issue, I have something to talk about. And it's even more difficult oftentimes to do it at home, especially if they come from a culture that's quite conservative or a family that's quite conservative. Now, going back to the sociocultural determinants, of course, where we see impoverished people living in impoverished environments, we see these difficulties and mental health issues and physical health issues applying tenfold. So they're more likely to get pregnant at an earlier age, they're more likely to engage in unhealthy behaviors more so, and also they're less likely to have access to healthcare because usually services are offered in big centers. They're not offered in smaller aspect of media. There are recent studies being done for e-health that can provide the opportunity for people in remote areas to have access to either, whether it is sexuality education or health education, and to address their issues if there is proper identification of their problem at their context. But it's also a matter of funding a lot of times. If the funding is not there for the efforts to be applied, then they're never going to get out of that inequality, and that's going to be a vicious cycle that goes on. So people who don't have opportunities can't create the opportunities. We need to help them create the opportunities.
Yes. Thank you very much. Please can you check or have always a look on the light, because the interpreter told that your microphone is switch on, off, and on, off. Yes. Maybe there is a mobile phone next to the microphone or like that. No. Okay. The next who asked for the floor is Stella. The floor is yours, Stella.
Thank you. First of all, I'd like to thank Doreen for taking on this initiative and having this report, and thanking Eleni for her presentation. I think it's an extremely interesting report because it highlights a number of issues that have often gone below the radar. And there are two aspects I wanted us to discuss further. First of all, we very rarely talk about adolescents except when we're discussing what a problem they are and how difficult it is to have children or grandchildren who are at that age. But in fact, this has led to us not addressing their needs as being different to the rest of the population. So we have children hospitals or hospitals for adults, but it's as if the ages of adolescents don't need to have specialized medical professionals or health professionals. So I wanted to ask you about this, whether the need for specialized training for professionals specifically dealing with adolescent care. It's as if someone who works with adults can also work with a 17-year-old, or someone who works with children can also work with a 17-year-old. And we seem to be losing out that age where their developmental changes are so evident. Mm-hmm. And the second point, as adults, we tend to be very aware that children need protection. But in fact, adolescents also need a lot of protection. Although they're at an age when they're striving to become independent, they're also at a higher risk for mental health problems, for risk-taking behavior, and others. So do we also need to raise more awareness in terms of the protection of the age of adolescence as an age when parents shouldn't just be aware that they're trying to become independent, but they also need to have protection to be able to guide them through this difficult stage of development? Thank you.
Eleni, I want to collect. Eleni, sorry?
Try if that's working.
Is it working now?
It's working.
1 minute, please. I want to collect one question more so that we can, that you can give answer for two questions. Sahin?
Thank you for this interesting presentation, from which I learned quite useful figures about the 75% of mental health disorders which present before the age of 24, and then 50% the age of 14. And I understand these are different reasons for different causes for these problems as mental health among the adolescents. The genes probably is the genetical problems, the family, the environment, the external environment in the school. One other problem that I would like to draw the attention of this committee is probably the children which have suffered violence in the conflict or in the war areas. Here in this committee, we had a report already on this topic with Mrs. Fataliyeva, Children in Conflict Zones. And we had conflicts in the past, we have current conflicts, and we have future conflicts. I wonder if, I mean, talking about the report itself, whether it could also serve a purpose of some sort of a warning or a caution to the countries which are currently, or the regions which are currently in conflicts or in wars, what and how they should deal with the adolescents when they come to the age of 24 and 14. I mean, we had children, for example, in former Yugoslavia, in the conflict there, with, we have representatives here from Bosnia and Herzegovina, from Croatia, and also Serbia. I wonder if they had any statistics, any research and studies on how the war actually affected the children, and how these figures, the 75%, 50%, well, what was happening in compared to the previous period, before war period? What was the difference? What were the main problems, addiction, what other consequences? Because it could serve a good purpose for the countries like Ukraine or Georgia, Moldova, with current conflicts dealing with Russian aggression, what to expect. Maybe we should already start doing some sort of monitoring and put these children, the IDPs, for example, internally displaced people, among which 30% are children, on special observation, and what specifically we should be looking at, you know, at the level of the other psychologists, Ministry of Healthcare or Ministry of Education. Maybe even we should attract schools and schooling system, the educational system, where these children are going to and provide some additional methodical and recommendation. Every school has a psychologist in Ukraine for sure, but I don't think the psychologists are prepared for these kind of issues to deal with. So I wonder if we could also take a note in the report about that. Thank you.
Okay, Eleni, you're
can I? Yeah. Thank you. I will start with the last question, talking about children or adolescents affected from conflict and violence. There is some data from previous war situations and things like that. However, sometimes they're not readily available. The other issue is, and it's mentioned in the memorandum, that a lot of the times, especially in Europe, we focus on separate areas but not on issues as a whole. So this has created a problem in having the data that you mentioned before in terms of knowing what was there before and what was the need and how the needs change. What we do know, though, about trauma is that it does affect people in general, children and adolescents more so. And personally, I would recommend that we don't wait for the adolescents to become 24 for us to intervene, because then it would be too late for trauma. I know from my own experience with working with sexually abused children that the longer you wait, especially for children that are maladjusted, it's more difficult and more longer term and more costly to treat them. Therefore, if we have children that are affected in war zones or in detention areas or similar situations, it would be necessary to provide them with the necessary support, the professional support, as soon as possible, so that they can reintegrate into society as safely and as healthy as possible. I also think that we're in an unprecedented situation as a continent with all the war situations, but also with all the migration happening from various countries, and this presents a new challenge both for mental health and health professionals that we need to study it as well in order to know more so what the effects are, as opposed to somebody going through a one-time abusive event versus something so traumatic. We don't know so much. We know a lot more about soldiers going into war rather than children coming out of war. So research needs to be done in order to identify the needs of these specific groups. So would you like to say something?
Could I make a couple of comments on this? I think that, we know that the migrant population and the trafficked population of children is a very difficult one to tackle and very serious. And I think, we have many international declarations about this kind of thing, but it's really at country level this has to be dealt with, because those are the people who know what's happening. At least they may not know exactly what's happening. I heard a terrible statistic the other day from the UK where 200 young people go missing every week from domestic service or from what else, because they want to escape, and they disappear. They're not in any service, they're not found at all. And I think that one of the principles that I would say is that children should be treated as children first, and children goes up to the age of 18, according to the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. But these are children. And I think where we get into difficulty often is that when children are becoming adult,
there's a sort of cusp between about 17 and 19 where children are often treated as adults and they're put into psychiatric institutions which are for adults, they're put into prisons which are for adults. And this is just not good enough. It's also children who live in care sometimes. So I think that we have to treat children as children, and we have to have specialist services to do that. And very often we do not have those services in place, and children are left on the streets or lost, or they die. So I think the situation with children of that upper age level is particularly difficult, and they should be treated as children.
If I can go back to the first question in terms of specialist services and the training, it is true that a lot of professionals tend to focus their training in under 10s or 12s, especially pediatricians, and then you have and also psychologists and psychiatrists. I know that for sure from my involvement with them. And then you have adult services. And what Doreen mentioned about psychiatric inpatient services, accepting 17-year-olds and treating them as adults is a big issue that happens many, many places, and it's a challenge for us. We do need specialist training because a lot of the times we tend to deal with adolescents of their behavior as something that is either abnormal, ignoring the context, or as normal part of adolescence. Sorry. And we just push it away saying, oh, it's just a phase. They're going to grow out of it. They're just shy at the age of 24. Sorry.
Yeah. But it's working. Yeah?
Okay. Can you hear me now?
One minute, Eleni. We have now only one question still open, and this is from Petra de Sutter. Please, Petra, I give you now the floor, and after Eleni can finish.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for your very interesting figures that you show and the work you've been doing. As a gynecologist, I'm interested in reproductive health, of course. I just wondered, looking at the figures that European Commission's report of 2000 noted in your draft, you mentioned these figures. Could you say something about abortion rates, access to contraception, differences within Europe, how to deal with that? Also, whether you have figures on teenage pregnancies, because they might be interesting. Abortion figures are quite similar, I think, with adult women's figures, as far as I can see. Doreen has talked about sexuality education. Would you say these things are really linked together? And then a second question that maybe goes together, I'm very interested in cross-sectionality in all these issues. So if you're talking about mental health issues, I can imagine mental health issues, also physical health issues, they can be connected with reproductive health issues. Can you elaborate a little bit on that? Thank you.
One minute. I read a report that was about Germany, that the soldiers in the German army are meanwhile by more than 10% under 18. We are fighting in the whole world against children soldiers. And now we have to check a little bit what is in our armies. Which is the age when young men or women can enter the army? Because I was a little bit shocked when I heard that the Deutsche Bundeswehr has so young people.
Patrick, I'll have a go at your questions on abortion, contraception, and teenage pregnancy. We have lots and lots of figures on teenage behaviour with regard to sexual behaviour. Some of it's in Europe, a lot of it's in the United States, of course, and that's different. But we have figures. Now, my question is, not particularly to you, but is of the accuracy of these figures? Because I think there is some underreporting, some overreporting. For example,
when you ask, it was one study, I think it was IPPF study, International Planned Parenthood Federation, where they asked boys 15 how often they had sex. Well, would you trust a reply from that? So this is why I'm a little bit concerned about statistics in that sense. I'm sure there are trends. I'm sure that we have some statistics which are better than others. Maybe the teenage pregnancy statistics are probably more accurate. And we've got those for Europe and for the United States. Abortion figures, yes, we have them, but I think that some of them are a little bit undefined. Maybe I should talk to you about this in detail. But we do have figures. As I say, I think that some of them are... we have figures in every single country in Europe, for example, in a chart. How much I trust of that, I really don't know, because I think that some is not reported, some is underreported, some is overreported. So, help Petra.
Okay. Just to follow up on what Doreen said and Baroness Massey said, the issue of abortion rates and teen pregnancy is an issue that connects very much, well, just like everything else, with mental health and physical health and all that, and with societal factors that we were talking about earlier. I would agree with Doreen that I wouldn't rely much on the numbers that we have. I cannot tell you much about that. Doreen has more so the numbers, but the reason why I agree with Doreen on the numbers or the lack of trust in the numbers is because you have to take into consideration the cultural context of the country, especially in terms of religious effects on decision-making and policy-making. You have to take into consideration also the legislation or lack of legislation in terms of availability of sexuality or health education, and when does it start and what is involved in that, but also in terms of legislation covering abortion rights for women and young girls. Therefore, you cannot rely on the numbers, to be honest, especially in countries where there is no law and things are done pretty much under the table.
So thank you very much for this introduction. I think it was very, very interesting. Thank all of you for the participation in this exchange, and we will go up ahead with in that case. And to Petra, if you need it, I have the figures. If you want to have it exactly, it's in the written paper from Eleni.
I do have numbers.
Yeah. Okay. Ah, you have it. Okay. Sorry. The chair of the Rules Committee must be very organized, and I know that. Sorry. Maybe I'm not so good organized than you. Now we have a break. A coffee break. It's outside. Because I want to start with the exchange of views with the Lewis report, then we have maybe not enough time. We have Mr. Kiefer and we have the minister. So how much time we have for the coffee break? 15 minutes? Yeah, please be back in 15 minutes. And after our morning work, we are invited for lunch. Oh, it's very close inside this house. Okay, thank you. please take seats that we can continue. Who is Casimati? Italian? Okay, we are coming now to the topic number 4, the role of national parliaments in successful decentralization process. Our rapporteur, and we discussed several times this report, is Luis. And for today we have an exchange of views with the Secretary of State for Local Authorities in Portugal, Mr. Carlos Miguel. Welcome. And also with Mr. Andreas Kiefer, the Secretary General of the Congress of Local and Regional Authorities of the Council of Europe. And after this exchange of views, we have to adopt the report, and it will be discussed in the plenary in October. So now, Luis, do you want to say some words about your report?
Muito obrigado. Nesta minha primeira intervenção, gostaria de vos dar as boas-vindas a todas e a todos. Cumprimentar naturalmente o Sr. Presidente, o Sr. Secretário de Estado e o Secretário-Geral do Congresso dos Poderes Locais e Regionais do Conselho da Europa. Cumprimentar também o Presidente da Comissão Parlamentar Portuguesa de Ambiente, Ordenamento do Território e Descentralização. E dizer que este relatório, que partiu de uma preocupação conjunta de vários deputados e de vários países que têm neste momento processos de descentralização em curso, parte de um princípio muito simples. Qual é o papel que os Parlamentos podem e devem ter nos processos de descentralização para que estes sejam realmente eficazes e respondam às expectativas? Em muitos casos, os Parlamentos têm sido marginalizados ou têm tido um papel menor nos processos de descentralização. E, naturalmente, tendo os Parlamentos um papel importante na aprovação das leis, na aprovação dos orçamentos e no acompanhamento e fiscalização de processos deste tipo, é nossa opinião que eles devem ter um papel central desde a primeira hora dos processos de descentralização até ao seu acompanhamento. O que nós procuramos foi, sobretudo, perceber o que é que está a acontecer nos vários países europeus. Quais são essas tendências? Em segundo lugar, quais são os fatores que, de alguma forma, contribuem para o sucesso e para o fracasso, noutros casos, dos vários processos de descentralização? E, em terceiro lugar, como é que nós podemos, de alguma forma, recomendar aos vários governos que introduzam nas suas práticas e nas suas decisões um conjunto de recomendações que, no final, façam destes processos que são fundamentais, não só em matéria de consolidação da democracia, de aproximação e aprofundamento de um conjunto de práticas fundamentais mesmo na defesa dos direitos humanos e na promoção de uma maior igualdade social e territorial, dizia que é importante que os governos possam melhorar essas práticas. Gostaria também de dizer que este relatório só foi possível porque desde a primeira hora houve um entendimento e uma colaboração muito estreita com o Congresso dos Poderes Locais e Regionais do Conselho da Europa. E foi também muito importante que, no seio das outras instituições, nomeadamente o Comitê de Democracia e Governança e a Comissão de Veneza, trabalhamos em conjunto no sentido de fazer deste relatório um documento importante e um documento no qual se pudessem refletir as várias sensibilidades, as várias posições e também que cada um assumisse o seu papel no seio da Assembleia Parlamentar, no seio do Conselho da Europa. Eu quero agradecer, portanto, ao André Schiffer o contributo inestimável que o Congresso deu desde a primeira hora e, naturalmente, agradecer à Júlia e à Maren, que antecedeu todo o trabalho desenvolvido sobre a direção da Tânia, desenvolvido pelos serviços que apoiam esta Comissão, e sem esse trabalho muito, muito relevante, nada disto seria possível. Naturalmente, poderemos melhorar, alterar tudo aquilo que entenderem, porque este documento ou este relatório pretende espelhar todas as sensibilidades e colher o maior consenso possível, como deve ser em documentos e em relatórios desta natureza. Muito obrigado a todos.
Thank you, Luis. I only want to add two sentences or three sentences. Your report comes just in the right moment. In this year, we have the 30th anniversary of the European Charter of Local Self-Government, which we are celebrating. And this gives us really the best opportunity to discuss this. And we continue the priority of the Croatian chairmanship of the Committee of Ministers, which choose the decentralization as one of their three priorities. And now I want to give Mr. Miguel the floor, and after Miguel I give the floor to Mr. Kiefer, and then I will collect your specific questions regarding the decentralization and the self-government of local communities and regions.
Com a devida vénia. Excelentíssimo Sr. Presidente da Comissão de Assuntos Sociais, Saúde e Desenvolvimento Sustentável do Conselho da Europa, Stefan Schenar, Excelentíssimo Sr. Vice-Presidente da Comissão de Assuntos Sociais, Saúde e Desenvolvimento Sustentável do Conselho da Europa, caro Luís Leite Ramos, Excelentíssimo Sr. Secretário-Geral do Congresso dos Poderes Locais e Regionais do Conselho da Europa, Andreas Kiefer, Excelentíssimas Senhoras Deputadas, Excelentíssimos Senhores Deputados, demais convidados, caros e caras concidadãos, a todos saúdo e a todos cumprimento. É para mim um privilégio participar nesta sessão da Comissão de Assuntos Sociais, Saúde e Desenvolvimento Sustentável do Conselho da Europa, quando se celebra e invoca os 30 anos da Carta Europeia da Autonomia Local, um marco e uma referência que nos convoca e conforta desde 1988. Esta sessão e esta invocação em Portugal assumem particular significado quando o Governo, a Assembleia da República, as autarquias e os cidadãos discutem a natureza e a extensão do poder local no presente e no futuro da administração pública nacional. Com um propósito reformador único, o Governo encetou um processo de profundas reformas, recentrando e evidenciando as autarquias locais como agentes da administração do Estado, mais próximas e mais eficazes, tornando mais equilibrada a administração pública. O Governo tem consciência e não esquece que a OCDE considera Portugal como um dos países mais centralizados da Europa. É com esta consciência e com a determinação de quem tem um saber de experiência feito que o Governo encara este desafio com enorme confiança na capacidade de fazer e servir dos municípios e das juntas de freguesia. As autarquias locais são atores de uma história de maior sucesso desde destes 44 anos de democracia portuguesa. Após as primeiras eleições livres em 1976, os autarcas sempre souberam bem interpretar as necessidades e o querer das populações e do país. Foram eles que asseguraram as infraestruturas básicas, depois construíram os equipamentos necessários, mais tarde assumiram os serviços à população e hoje dão prioridade à economia e à atratividade dos seus territórios. É com os autarcas que o Governo quer alicerçar a reforma do Estado, fazendo da descentralização de competências da administração central para a administração local a reforma das reformas. Como bem diz o Primeiro-Ministro, António Costa, a descentralização é a pedra angular da reforma do Estado. Foi com esta convicção que há 2 anos o Governo iniciou um processo de diálogo e consensualização com a Associação Nacional de Municípios e a Associação Nacional de Freguesias, cuja parceria enaltecemos publicamente e sempre com a Assembleia da República presentes nas mesmas. Trabalho minucioso, transparente e profícuo, cujos resultados legislativos estão aí. Trabalho político que envolveu e envolve todos os partidos com assento na Assembleia da República e cujo acordo celebrado com a nova direção do Partido Social Democrata permitiu um passo determinante na aprovação pela Assembleia da República da Lei 50/2018, chamada Lei Quadro da Descentralização, publicada a 16 de agosto último. Não foi fácil. Como nada é fácil quando é importante. Mas a Assembleia da República soube responder positivamente à necessidade de modernizar e aproximar a administração pública em Portugal. É agora tempo de materializar esta lei-quadro em múltiplos diplomas legais que vão da cultura à educação, passando pela saúde, pela justiça, pelo apoio social, pela proteção civil, pelo estacionamento automóvel, pela captação de investimento ou pela gestão das praias, num total de 21 diplomas setoriais. 21 diplomas setoriais que têm em comum a sua aplicabilidade a todo o território nacional e ao ritmo que cada autarquia melhor entender, na certeza que em 2021 todas as competências descentralizadas estarão a ser exercidas por todas as autarquias do continente. 21 diplomas que não põem em causa a natureza pública do serviço do Estado, nem a igualdade de oportunidades no acesso aos mesmos, muito antes pelo contrário. A universalidade transversal e horizontal são propósitos paradigmáticos da descentralização. Tem sido e continuará a ser um trabalho árduo, mas motivante, em que nada se negocia, mas tudo se consensualiza. Para tanto, e como já referi, o Governo tem sido transparente e leal com os parceiros, e estes têm respondido com igual procedimento. Já muito andamos, mas a jornada é longa. Temos tirado muitas pedras do caminho e contornado outras tantas, e é isso que iremos continuar a fazer. O Governo, o Primeiro-Ministro, eu próprio, temos a convicção, fruto do nosso empenho, que no próximo mês de outubro teremos todos os diplomas concertados com a Associação Nacional de Municípios e a Associação Nacional de Freguesias. E com isso, passaremos a ter uma administração pública mais ágil, mais próxima, mais eficaz, para melhor servir as pessoas e o território. Com a descentralização e com o envelope financeiro associado à mesma, sem que se aumente a despesa pública, o Governo converge para a meta de 19% de participação das autarquias locais na receita pública, conforme por si foi fixado no Programa Nacional de Reformas. Senhor Presidente, caras e caros concidadãos, o Governo encara as autarquias locais como verdadeiros parceiros. Parceiros de um fim que todos os dias queremos concretizar. Melhor servir as pessoas e melhor servir o território. Para isso, contamos com todos, com todos e todos seremos, não seremos demais, na construção de uma administração pública de futuro. Mais leve, mais equilibrada, mais eficaz, mais participada e mais escrutinada. Uma administração pública com menos poder central e mais poder local. Termino como comecei. Foi um privilégio usar da palavra aqui e agora. Faço votos que a luz de Lisboa nos ilumina todos nos caminhos do serviço público. Obrigado.
Mr. Miguel, we are honored that you are with us, and thank you for your words and your emotional and impressive speech. Are there any urgent question to Mr. Miguel? Then you have the chance to do it now. Otherwise, I give immediately the floor to Mr. Andreas Kiefer, the General Secretary of the Congress of Local and Regional Authorities of the Council of Europe. On Thursday in October, when we are discussing in the plenary the Lewis Report, the President of the Regions will also speak in the plenary.
Thank you very much, Mr. Schenach. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here. Luis Leite Ramos, you managed to bring together the three political actors of the Council of Europe dealing with decentralization, governments represented by Mr. Miguel, parliaments represented here by the host, the Parliamentary Assembly, and the Congress of Local and Regional Authorities. I will have the honor to meet again Minister Cabrita tomorrow, who addressed the Congress session to inform our members last year about the state of decentralization, and we will discuss the implementation and also see where the Congress can contribute with the experience from the other 46 member states in decentralization. Decentralization is always a difficult process that needs expertise, but also political luck. It is something that you cannot plan from the beginning. You have to deal with the representatives of the associations and so on. It is also a particular pleasure to be here in the month where we celebrate the 30th anniversary of the entry into force of the European Charter of Local Self-Government, this real milestone treaty that obliges voluntarily all member states to implement the principle of subsidiarity and proximity to enable decisions being taken as close as possible to the citizens. In the Congress, we are very pleased that this report prepared by Mr. Leite Ramos comes now, because there we see in some countries trends to recentralization. We see trends where trust between the different levels is in decline, and I think this report can once more highlight the role of governments, but especially of parliaments, in decentralization processes, a role that is very often neglected. Some governments have attempted to recentralize powers and competences given to local authorities, and especially to curtail their financial resources, instead of adopting a partnership approach where the best ideas and the experiences from the practical level can contribute to address economic and societal changes. We think that in the Council of Europe, but in all the bodies, we cannot adopt a wait-and-see approach when local democracy is losing ground and the positive and constructive effects of the proximity of service and democratic institutions to citizens are being denigrated, when the readiness and ability to contribute to solutions is being ignored or not taken on board wholeheartedly. This is why the Congress welcomes the draft report and resolution, which reconfirm the role of national parliaments in supporting decentralization and strengthening local democracy as precondition to the well-being and democratic security of our societies. When the Charter entered into force, we were not sure when all members of the Council of Europe family would join. Now, since 2014, when San Marino, when Monaco and Andorra were the last countries to ratify the Charter, we are very proud that all 47 member states have committed to these values. And this is in no small measure an achievement of the national parliaments. Why? Well, the national parliaments have the role to ratify the charter as a second step to set the legal framework for local and regional governance, for decentralization processes. They can scrutinize governments and, when needed, bring them back on the way to upholding the commitments under the Charter, for example, on the basis of the Congress monitoring reports. And finally, it is the parliaments which can steer the countries in the consolidation of democratic institutions at all levels, at the national level, at regional level, and at local level, bearing in mind the requirements of the European Charter of Local Self-Government. The Secretary General of the Council of Europe, Mr. Jagland, stated in his 2016 annual report that, and I quote, "there is a dangerous trend towards legislative nationalism," end of quote, which sees some member states initiating laws which risk contravening international standards or challenge the application of international treaties like the conventions of the Council of Europe. Well, we are not here to air grievances only. We are here also to seek for solutions, what we can do to remedy the situation and to bring our citizens, who partly feel excluded from democratic processes, back on board, having them work side by side with governments and parliaments. And I'm confident that the Charter of Local Self-Government does play an important role in translating this common objective into reality. It introduces the principle of subsidiarity and brings decision-making powers as close to the citizens as possible. By ratifying the Charter, all member states have now committed themselves to implementing the principles. But the Charter also has an impact beyond the Council of Europe. It is interesting to note that non-member states are more and more interested in learning from the practice of the Charter. And we just came back with a mission of our president and president of the monitoring committee and others from Belarus, where the parliament of Belarus organized, together with the Congress, a workshop and several round tables on the principles of the Charter and called for a strengthened cooperation with the Congress in order to better address the issue of local self-government in the country. This is one more example that we can be proud of the achievements of the Council of Europe treaties. And as it was mentioned this morning in the opening speeches, the Sustainable Development Goals of the United Nations is also something that we are focusing on, and with our work in the Congress, with the work in the Parliamentary Assembly, and the work of the Committee of Ministers, the Council of Europe is contributing to the implementation of the SDGs. We celebrate 30 years of the Charter, but there is one aspect that we must not forget. Not all countries have ratified all provisions of the Charter. And for the Congress, it remains an objective that 100% of the Charter is being applied on 100% of the territory. We welcome, therefore, that the Parliamentary Assembly in this report supports this objective of 100% of the Charter on 100% of the territory and calls on member states to ratify the non-ratified provisions of the Charter. Please follow this up in your respective national parliaments also to contribute to achieving this objective, which the Parliamentary Assembly is about to formulate it. The Congress is the monitoring body for the Charter, and over the last years we have identified several recurring issues where several member states have problems in implementing the Charter. That's one, the inadequacy of financial resources, Article 9, the restricted definition, allocation and exercise of local competences, thirdly, the lack of meaningful consultation, and finally, the absence of direct applicability in courts. This is also an issue we are looking into. So the consultation is one of the problematic areas where the Congress is working on improving the situation, and we will very much use the report that the Parliamentary Assembly is going to adopt finally in October to encourage national governments and parliaments to get involved in a meaningful dialogue. The Congress will adopt in November guidelines for consultation, and I'm very glad that in your draft resolution you also refer to these guidelines, and we encourage you as national parliamentarians also to make use of them in your committees or subcommittees when preparing legislation on decentralization. Looking into the future, the Congress will continue promoting local and regional self-governments and to monitor the application of the European Charter of Local Self-Governments. We will continue to oppose governments' attempts to use economic arguments to re-centralize competences, squeeze local budgets, and reduce taxing powers and financial autonomy of subnational governments. We will continue to defend and promote the right of local authorities to be consulted timely and efficiently by national governments and national parliaments. However, to be successful in our activities, we, local authorities, need your support in your national parliaments as well as in the Parliamentary Assembly. The common challenges are huge. There are threats to democracy and to the accountability at different levels. These cross-cutting areas and problems need joint addressing jointly by national governments, national parliaments, and local authorities. We welcome Mr. Leyte Ramos's report, especially because it takes a robust position to secure decentralization and democratic security. It also shows, and especially this setting of this podium, that all the three political bodies of the Council of Europe have to work together. They address the same issues, but from different angles. And this is why we remain also and will be in the future very complementary. The Congress is happy to continue the thematic and political cooperation with the Assembly that goes beyond the topic of local democracy only, because local authorities are responsible for many areas that have a relevance for people's everyday life. The Congress is presenting in November a handbook on local the local dimension of human rights, a practical handbook for mayors, and we will make this available also for the Parliamentary Assembly for your use when you are talking to mayors and encouraging them to implement the values of the Council of Europe. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Kiefer. Thank you also for all the Portuguese officials who helped in the last time so much in our different meetings we had. And I think again to Luis, because Luis was representing our committee in the Congress. And but I promised Mr. Kiefer that we will nominate a new person. And this new person is a Swiss man. It's Mr. Grain, I think Jean-Pierre Grain, who will step in the footprints of Louis. Now, dear colleagues, any questions to our two experts or to our rapporteur? Please.
In the UK, we have been for a number of years decentralizing the planning process. It's obviously crucial to individuals that they have control over individual planning applications that take place in their own villages. But one of the difficulties that we've come about, that has come about with this, is that many of those people love the system, they love the decentralization that's involved, until a decision is made by one of the councils that they have to partner with that goes against them, at which point they flock back to try to get MPs to take another view in this. Do you have any suggestions as to how this can be overcome?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First one, I want to thank for the excellent report. I'm the head of the Finnish sparsely populated areas parliamentary group, and we are trying to find concrete means how to get countryside more living or more vital. It includes the areas where are 68% of the area of Finland, but only 5.3% of people. So they live 2.5 person per cubic kilometers. Things, but huge area, 68%. Okay, and first of all, I think that it's only that we could have governmental institutions separated. I think facilities in those areas are as important. First of all, accessibility, transportation and a network must be good enough that we can do it, and people should want to go back to the areas, because if media and people are some kind against it, it doesn't work. So first of all, we have to get services there, we have to get more companies there, we have to have sustainable bioeconomy there as well. But very often when we try to do concrete decisions, I notice that there is prohibited state aid in EU. For example, if we try to use measures that have used, for example, in Norway, in Finland, we can do that, including tax systems in northern country in Norway or subsidies when people come back. And what I would like to mention in this fantastic report is that we could have positive discrimination, so to can have means to do better way concrete things.
In Austria, we say when the women are leaving the villages, then the villages will die, more or less speed. And if you have no offers for women in the villages for the interest to live a self-determined living, education, communication, and others, then you cannot stop this process. Money enough alone is not the answer. That is a fact. But by the way, from Lubov, Sergei asked for the floor. It's a very interesting city in the western Ukraine. And after Mr. Amraoui from Maroc asked for the floor. I think then, and Mr. Essel from Austria. So, then I want to ask the podium, do you want to reply for the first two questions now? We can summarize all. Serhii, you are the next.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have to correct you that it's Lviv. You can say Lemberg, but not Lvov, please. my questions are, I have three, in fact, questions to our guests and also to ourselves, maybe as part of the ideas. One question maybe to Mr. Kiefer is, we have seen in Europe also of the examples when the central authorities trying to attack the leaders of local communities, particularly if these leaders have ambitions to become national leaders, from becoming small local leaders. Sometimes, because this many countries, the system is centralized, like US, we've heard about Portugal and many countries where central governments still have a lot of tools and resources to influence or to restrict the activities of local leaders. They are abusing their authority for that. So if you put the political side aside, because this is, of course, debatable, who is right and who is wrong, but the fact that the central authority is abusing its powers and using it for the purposes of political persecution, wouldn't you think that maybe you as a Congress shall play a role of a kind of a local authorities watchdog or the local mayor's rights protection watchdog and speak out whenever you see such instances happening in these or other countries? It may not or may have an impact on the change of behavior of the leaders of the central authorities, but in any case it would definitely inspire and give hope and maybe also some strength to these local leaders that they are doing things in a proper way and they are right and they should continue to work for the benefits of their communities. The second issue is we discussed it in the committee. Unfortunately, I was not present in the previous committee meetings. Is the discrepancy, disbalance of the decentralization of financial resources with the decentralization of responsibilities? And we are seeing it right now in Ukraine where, yes, there was a decentralization of financial resources 2-3 years ago. The cities are making 30-40% more money into their local budgets. But then they do not have enough powers to ensure public, for example, public safety, public health issues. Like the report I'm writing or working on right now is air pollution, and I already see that, yes, 60% of people live in the cities, but the cities, in fact, do not have enough powers to regulate. Some have, and some are banning, for example, diesel cars, but some doesn't have. But at the end, this is the responsibilities of the local authorities to do that. So, yes, they can have money, they can have resources, but without having the power to regulate and to make decisions, this is problematic. So the question is, wouldn't be also an idea maybe on some supranational level, the Congress, maybe the Council of Europe, maybe some other organizations, to make a list or to make a guidebook, a blueprint, a white paper, whatever, the list of powers, maybe under some international conventions like Paris Agreement or others or Covenant of Mayors, which are obliging or empowering the mayors to play a bigger role in contributing to the solution of to solving these global problems, that give them these powers as a form of pressure on the central parliament or the central government to regulate. And the last one, Mr. Chair, maybe this is the idea also for the committee in relation to this report to have a declaration or the address, a declaration. The problem the parliaments have sometimes, okay, they can play a good role, but they can play also a negative role. And we see it today when the parliaments are delaying appointing local elections in some of the municipalities. And this is a major thing in Ukraine, and it happens in two instances. When, for example, a mayor died, and there is a fight between different political groups, some with good connections to the ruling coalition party, and they are delaying because the interim, the acting mayor, is from their party. So they don't want to appoint new elections, not to appoint to elect a new mayor, because their acting mayor is from their party. And another problem is that when you have a decentralization reform, when the administrative units, the villages, are becoming bigger, so they're becoming less in quantity, with more resources allocated to them, the elections, again, by the parliaments are delayed to appoint in these new administrative bodies, the so-called reformed municipalities. So maybe we, as the committee, in connection to this report, could make a declaration urging the parliaments, or maybe it could be part of the resolution as well, not to delay and to appoint elections wherever they haven't been appointed or significantly delayed by now, because we are violating the right of local communities for the electing their own leaders. Thank you. Sorry for this long.
Mr. Amraoui, please.
Merci, Monsieur le Président. La réussite du processus de décentralisation, bien sûr avec un droit au développement et égalité des chances de tous les territoires, reste tributaire des moyens financiers et aussi humains dont dispose le pouvoir local ou régional. Et ceci de façon encore plus aiguë pour les collectivités pauvres et qui dépendent du degré de solidarité que joue l'État ou le pouvoir national dans la répartition donc des richesses. Et là, je ne voyais pas que le rôle, c'est limité des parlementaires, même s'ils ont un rôle majeur dans la discussion et le vote des lois de finances chaque année que le Parlement peut s'y apporter. Aussi, un deuxième point sur, m'intrigue un petit peu, c'est ces cumuls de mandats dans certains pays, dans d'autres, le cumul de mandats local et national. Quel impact positif ou négatif peut-il avoir sur le processus, à votre avis?
Okay, und als letzter Herr Essler von Österreich, bitte.
Danke, Herr Präsident. Wenn man von Dezentralisierung redet, dann redet man unweigerlich natürlich auch vom ländlichen Raum. Und unsere Gesellschaft ist ja so aufgebaut, dass die Regeln eher der städtischen Bevölkerung zugutekommen, seien das allgemeine Regeln oder sogar auch die Regeln des Marktes. Es ist nun einmal möglich, in den Ballungszentren billiger zu produzieren und eine bessere Anbindung an den Markt zu haben. Und darum brauchen die ländlichen Regionen auch Unterstützung. Das wäre einmal finanzielle Unterstützung, aber auch Unterstützung in der Entscheidungsgewalt. Ich glaube, dass wenn man die Bedürfnisse der ländlichen Bevölkerung kennen will und wenn man diese dann unterstützen will, dass wir auch finanzielle Mittel einsetzen müssen, um in der Entscheidungsfindung die Regionen entsprechend zu berücksichtigen. Ich bedanke mich dabei bei dem Kongress der Regionen. Andreas Kiefer ist ja da federführend beteiligt. Ich bedanke mich dafür für den Einsatz. Eine Frage hätte ich noch an den Herrn Staatssekretär. Wie ist das in Portugal geregelt? Gibt es zwischen der nationalen Ebene und den Gemeinden noch eine Entscheidungsebene oder nicht?
Dankeschön, thank you. Now to the podium. Please, now short answers. The time is running very, very speed. And we have to adopt a preliminary draft resolution, paragraph by paragraph and in all. And also we have to move on in the topic number 6. So please, short answers, please, that we can go ahead. And to the interpreters, excuse me, maybe we are 10 minutes, have maybe 10 minutes over time. Don't kill me in the lunchtime.
Três questões que eu sou, digamos, estou mais desperto para as mesmas. A primeira questão tem a ver com o planeamento do território. Para vos dizer que em Portugal há 42 anos não era assim, mas houve um caminho, digamos, progressivo e hoje em dia todo o planeamento do território é feito pelas câmaras municipais, é feito pelo poder local que tenha que agir em respeito com aquilo que são as cartas nacionais. E o governo só intervém quando não há coincidência, quando o plano aprovado pela Câmara Municipal tem alguma divergência com uma carta nacional. Mas o poder está, digamos, do lado dos municípios. As questões da ruralidade e da baixa densidade é uma questão transversal a toda a Europa e Portugal, sendo um pequeno país em território, tem os mesmos problemas e as mesmas questões, em que há uma grande assimetria entre os territórios junto à costa atlântica e todos os territórios do interior. E aquilo que hoje é muito atual em Portugal é essa discussão do que fazer, que medidas positivas, que discriminação positiva pode ser feita para que os territórios do interior não percam população e possam ganhar, nomeadamente ganhar investimento. E algumas medidas têm sido tomadas, desde a redução das taxas nas autoestradas para quem vai para o interior, desde também de programas específicos de apoio à economia para o interior mais vantajosos que para o litoral. Por isso, é uma discussão em aberto e em que procuramos, digamos, o caminho para lá chegar. Dizer-vos também que a limitação de mandatos é uma regra em Portugal há algum tempo a esta parte. E eu, que sempre fui autarca, nos meus 60 anos de idade, 30 anos foi de autarca, ou são de autarca, eu sempre concordei e concordo com a limitação de mandatos, nomeadamente para as autarquias, que são 3 mandatos de 4 anos, ou seja, um total de 12 anos, e que permite uma renovação das pessoas e das ideias. Por último, em Portugal só temos 2 níveis de decisão. Ou seja, não temos regiões, embora a Constituição da República o preveja. Há 10 anos atrás tivemos um referendo e a população não aceitou, digamos, a regionalização. E por isso nós hoje temos o nível do governo central e o nível das autarquias locais. E no patamar intermédio temos instituições que representam o governo e que não têm autonomia nem decisão, nem são eleitas democraticamente. É ainda um passo que falta Portugal dar e esperemos que eu possa dar o quanto mais breve possível, porque também, pessoalmente, entendo que a região, o patamar intermédio, é determinante para combater as assimetrias, a interioridade e a especificidade que cada zona do país tem, diferente de qualquer uma outra. E por aqui me fico. Muito obrigado.
Thank you. Now, Mr. Kiefer.
Thank you very much. Mr. Howell, I think capacity building on one hand, that means local authorities governed by elected politicians and the administrations under their authority must be capable to really do. And secondly, the identity as a politician, accountability. That needs courage. So it is something where we see it's more and more difficult to get people serving because they are always attacked in the public for whatever they do. So it is this encouragement of people to take decisions and be accountable to what they do. So not in an attitude, well, whatever is good, it's my decision, and whatever is bad, somebody else has taken decision. So this is a bit the identity of a politician also at the local level. And we have seen this recently in Georgia, where a decentralization process is underway, where they changed the system to elect the mayors directly. And the minister in charge told me, it's unbelievable. Ministers, the mayors, before the direct elections, always came to the government and asked, well, what do you want us to do? And now with the direct elections, they come, my people want that we do this and this and that. So they have a different identity as representatives of the people. And that, of course, needs also training and a change in mentality. Mrs. Calamari and Mr. Essel, the rural areas are also at the heart of the work of the Congress. We have recently produced a report on the future of rural areas addressing all the challenges that you have from education, employment, health services, accessibility, the opportunities with decentralizing or outsourcing qualified labor by public authorities. In the district, for example, where Minister Essel lives, the regional government of the Land Salzburg in Austria has decentralized a service on all traffic fines. All the traffic fines are processed in a remote area of this region. That's one option where also national or regional governments can set examples. So this is something I would like to invite you to have a look at this Congress report as well. Mr. Kirai, Ukraine is going through a process of decentralization with steps forward and some back, but mainly forward. And I have the pleasure to be in Ternopil in one of those seminars on decentralization in 2 weeks, where we as Council of Europe try to show these good examples that you mentioned. Well, how can we encourage mayors and councillors to base their activities on a good European standard? Well, one source for this is the Congress monitoring reports. Another one is the reference framework for regional democracy that concerns more the regional level, for the oblast, something very relevant, which is more or less a menu where member states, but also the local and regional actors can choose from. So this is something that is very good. And then there are international networks also of municipalities, the Council of European Municipalities and Regions, for example. These are pressure groups, whereas the Congress, like the Parliamentary Assembly, has an institutional role. So we cannot play the same role. We have our mandate in monitoring the charter and giving recommendations, but not being, so to say, the pressure group for them. En ce qui concerne le Maroc, nous envisageons aussi une coopération avec le Maroc, l'association des villes, à partir du mois de novembre. Ça veut dire que le Congrès va suivre l'exemple de l'Assemblée parlementaire. Nous allons accueillir une délégation des élus marocaines en tant que partenaire pour la démocratie locale. Et avec l'expérience que a le Congrès, nous essayons de soutenir aussi ce processus de décentralisation, de donner des pouvoirs et des responsabilités, aussi des responsabilités financières aux municipalités au niveau local au Maroc. Et nous sommes très heureux d'avoir maintenant la possibilité d'établir cette coopération aussi dans la réalité après les signatures. Merci, Monsieur le Président.
Thank you very much. Do you want to make two sentences as a closing remark? Thank you.
Muito obrigado. Queria primeiro agradecer os contributos do Sr. Secretário de Estado do Poder Local, os contributos do Sr. Secretário-Geral do Congresso dos Poderes Locais e Regionais e os contributos de todos aqueles que intervieram e as questões e as sugestões formuladas. Uma primeira nota sobre o papel dos parlamentos. Eu insisto na ideia de que o Parlamento que aprova o orçamento anual, que aprova as leis da descentralização, não pode ter um papel menor em todo este processo. Mas mais do que aprovar a lei, as leis e o orçamento, o Parlamento tem o dever, a obrigação, em todos os sistemas e em todos os países, de acompanhar processos desta natureza. E julgo que até agora esse papel da monitorização, da avaliação e do acompanhamento em geral de processos com esta complexidade e com esta sensibilidade não tem sido feito. E tirando alguns países que têm bons sistemas desta natureza, os outros não têm feito e, do meu ponto de vista, o papel dos parlamentos tem que ser reforçado. Há uma dificuldade muito grande, é que nós temos sistemas políticos e temos enquadramentos constitucionais muito diversos. O Quiral levantou a questão, uma questão concreta, específica, relativamente a um sistema
eleitoral é um sistema político que se verifica na Ucrânia, mas, por exemplo, que em Portugal e em outros países que têm um sistema ligeiramente diferente, a questão não se coloca. E as realidades são muito diversas. Mas eu considero que a ideia de produzirmos uma declaração ou irmos mais longe em alguns aspectos é importante. Mas eu chamo a atenção, e aliás, como dizia o Sr. Secretário-Geral, que no Conselho da Europa nós temos um conjunto de instrumentos que estão, é possível aplicar e que grande parte dos países não as aplicou. Não só lembro, por exemplo, o protocolo adicional relativamente à Carta Europeia do Poder Local e Regional, do Poder Local e do autogoverno, e relembro também um conjunto de outras indicações em várias instâncias que não está a ser implementadas. E julgo que uma das formas de nós irmos um pouco mais longe é exatamente em cada um dos nossos países conseguirmos que haja um maior compromisso relativamente à democracia local, relativamente aos direitos políticos, sociais e outros das várias comunidades, e dessa forma julgo que combateremos muitas das dúvidas e muitas das dificuldades aqui levantadas. E, portanto, eu acho que o grande desafio é nós continuarmos este trabalho, mesmo depois do relatório estar eventualmente aprovado e debatido, e podermos, de alguma forma, levar mais longe este esforço de mais democracia, uma democracia com mais qualidade e maior defesa e promoção dos direitos em todos os campos sociais, políticos, económicos e outros. Muito obrigado.
Obrigado, Luis. Thank you very much. Now, dear colleagues, we are coming to the vote for the resolution from Luis, the role of national parliaments in successful decentralization process. Paragraph 1. Anybody against? Abstention, otherwise unanimously adopted. Paragraph 2 is unanimously adopted. Paragraph 3, against, abstention, unanimously adopted. Paragraph 4, unanimously adopted. Paragraph 5, anybody against, abstentions? No, it's unanimously adopted. Paragraph 6, any abstentions? Somebody contra? No. It's unanimously adopted. Paragraph 7. Unanimously adopted. 7.1. I can't declare it is unanimously adopted, but 7.1. No abstentions? No, nobody against. Okay. 7. Unanimously adopted. 2. 7.1.2. I look around, nobody, no abstentions, nobody contra, it's unanimously. 7.1.3, can I declare is unanimously adopted, thank you. 7.1.4, I'm looking around, okay, it's also unanimously adopted. 7.1.5, thank you. Unanimously adopted. 7.2. It's a title. So I can declare it as unanimously adopted. 7.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Kiral.
Yeah. Just going back to the previous 7.5, what I was talking about. 7.5. I wanted...
7.1.5.
Yeah? I wanted to the advice of Mr. Ramos. From what I talked about, the Parliament having both the positive and could have also the negative effect. One of that is in many of our countries and our states, the parliaments are
pointing... Sorry, I want to ask you something. Can you do it in a written way? We have it in October, yeah, in the committee, and then we can implement.
Yeah, I can, but I was about to suggest a very simple phrase. Maybe we could add.
Okay, tell me the phrase, please.
We can add a new paragraph where applicable, the Parliament must assume diligently its role by appointing local elections in a timely manner. Something like that.
You have
because
it?
This
No, wait. Yeah? I ask first the secretariat. Please repeat.
Where applicable means that maybe not all the states' parliaments are voting on local elections, but I assume it's basically everywhere. The parliaments should assume diligently its role on appointing local elections in a timely manner, without delay or in a timely manner.
Okay. What is the opinion of the rapporteur?
Eu não tenho opinião neste momento sobre o contributo. A minha questão é a seguinte, nós estamos a falar de descentralização, não estamos a falar do papel do Parlamento nos vários processos eleitorais. A minha pergunta é se essa alteração não pode criar aqui nenhum tipo de conflito, na medida em que cada Parlamento tem que assumir as suas responsabilidades que estão na Constituição e na lei relativamente ao cumprimento das mesmas. A minha pergunta é, faz sentido nós recomendarmos aos Parlamentos que sejam diligentes no cumprimento das suas responsabilidades constitucionais? Mas se isso é importante, poderemos discuti-lo. Agora, precisamos de mais tempo para avaliar a eficácia e, sobretudo, o enquadramento de uma recomendação desse género.
As chair, I'm on the side of Luis, because I'm coming from a country where we have the decentralization and federalism, and you cannot. This what you want is against the spirit of this resolution, and I really ask you. This is not the parliament responsible for the election in the village. It has nothing to do. Everybody is self-responsible, and please don't ask that. Otherwise, I would also ask the colleagues to vote against, as it, I think the same what Luis Ramos said just now.
I'm not against that. I agree to put it into a context together with Mr. Ramos, and then I'm sure we can work out a compromise, because there is a reason for that. I don't necessarily agree with all the arguments, but I agree that we need more time. Maybe we can discuss it during lunch and during 2 days and be ready for the October. Thank you.
Okay, so please understand. I understand that you have a process of development that at the moment in Ukraine, and we cannot put all the reasons of such cases now in a resolution. So I go ahead. You agree? Okay. The last I asked was 7.2. There was no abstentions and no contra, so I can move ahead. 7.2.1. I unanimously adopted. 7.2.2. No abstentions, no contra. Okay. 7.2.3. The same, I can declare as unanimously adopted. 7.2.4. No abstentions, nobody against. 7.2.5. Also unanimously adopted. 7.3. I see nobody knows, no deputatos, it's okay. You sit and the deputatos are on the ground, so it's okay. Okay, 7.4. Okay, it's adopted. 7.4.1. Also adopted. 7.4.2. Thank you. Adopted. 7.4.3. Also unanimously agreed. 7.4.4. Adopted. 7.4.5. Nobody is against. No abstentions. And at finally, paragraph 8. No abstentions. Nobody is against. And now, dear colleagues, I ask to vote in the whole. Who is in favor? Please, now, the only thing I ask you, show to be in favor for this report. Okay, thank you. Who is against? Madame Timmermans, you are not against. No contra, no. Any abstentions? No. So, congratulations. Unanimously adopted. Great. And I also want that you take note that the very interesting explanatory memorandum is at its stance. And now, after the voting, this report is adopted. Okay? Thank you. And on Thursday, during the afternoon sitting, please ask for the floors and debate with us and with Luis this report. Now let's say 15 to 20 minutes. And Madame Reina de Bruin Wesman has to leave us. And so we move on to this item. And are you, Madame, are you ready? Okay. I want to give you immediately the floor. And I want to tell you that the additional protocol to the Convention on Human Rights on Biomedicine concerning the protection of human rights and dignity of persons with mental disorder with regard on involuntary placement and treatment is on the way, and we apply to all parliaments for the ratification. And I give now the floor to you. And we have also a high-level guest from Portugal. It's Mr. Xavier. Please, Mr. Xavier, come to us. Mr. Xavier, Miguel Xavier, is professor of psychiatry and the director of the mental health program in the Ministry of Health of Portugal. And warmly welcome.
Thank you.
And thank you for your participation. Please make introduction, please.
Thank you, Mr. Scheer. I apologize that we have a short time, but because I have to catch my plane directly after lunchtime. So, at this moment in the case against the Council of Europe Legal Instrument on Involuntary Measures in Psychiatry, in which the Assembly opposed the drafting of the additional protocol that the Chair just mentioned, we are now in the situation that the DHBO decided to send a draft additional protocol for comments to some relevant Council of Europe committees and bodies, as mentioned in my preliminary draft comments. Now we have a renewed opportunity to comment on the revised draft additional protocol, and in particular, I welcome the declassification of the new draft, which will allow other stakeholders, including relevant UN mechanisms, NGOs, and associations of people with psychosocial disabilities, to see the changes made to the draft protocol since 2015. However, the changes that have been made are just a few, and have even gone in the wrong direction. I will come to that later on. Since the changes are few, the comments made by our committee in April in 2017 by the 10th chairperson, Mrs. Stella Kyriakides. Stella, welcome. I'm glad you're here. Remain fully valid to this day, and I see no sense of repeating them. In 2017, this committee justified the submission of the comments on the draft protocol as follows, and I quote, "Despite the Assembly's fundamental opposition to the drafting of this protocol, it's important that the Assembly closely follows the work thereon, both regarding content, how to minimize the negative effects of the additional protocol may have on the rights of people with psychosocial disability, as well on the credibility of the Council of Europe as a regional human rights organization and to the procedure how to ensure that an adequate involvement of disability rights organizations in the drafting procedure. End of quote. I conclude that this motivation remains correct this day. So I concentrated my draft comments on explaining the reasons of the Assembly's fundamental opposition to the draft protocol, focusing on questions about procedure and content. I first come to the procedure. The drafting procedure of the DHBIO has not respected Article 4.3 of the UNRCPD as regard to the necessary close and active consultation with the organizations representing people with disabilities. At my knowledge, the DHBIO invited disability and mental health organizations only twice, in June and November 2017, to its meeting and at their own costs. On 14th of May 2018, the European Disability Forum sent an open letter to the Secretary General of the Council of Europe in which they convened their deepest concerns and position to the adoption of the draft additional protocol to the Oviedo Convention and announced that they would not attend the upcoming meeting of the DHBIO in May 2018 because their inputs have been systematically ignored. They found it very concerning that the organizations of persons with disability are not consulted in a meaningful way. The close nature of the work of the DHBIO has also been criticized by the main UN mechanisms concerned. I thus agree with the NGOs that the good faith, transparency, mutual respect and meaningful dialogue and sincere desire to reach consensus, which are the foundation stone of the CRPD process, have not been met by the DHBIO. Then I come to the content. The draft additional protocol is not fit for purpose. It will not protect people with psychosocial disabilities from violations of their human rights and will not reduce the number of involuntary measures. On the contrary, it risks increasing such measures by regulating what should be the exception. It also risks weakening current protection by using incorrect and dangerous imprecise terms and definitions. In her 2017 comments, Mrs. Kyriakides Stella gave multiple examples of such dangerous drafting in the comments of the draft protocol. But she was not the first. Several high-level human rights bodies during the 2015 public consultation already highlighted serious problems with the definitions and terms used. None of these concerns have been adequately addressed in the revised draft additional protocol. On the contrary, the addition of a Chapter 6 dealing with specific situations on seclusion and restraint and on treatment with the aim of producing irreversible effects makes it worse. So is Article 17 on seclusion and restraint not subject of the provisions of Article 16. Which concerns appeals and reviews of the lawfulness of involuntary placement or involuntary treatment. In other words, a patient has no right to appeal to a court to have a lawfulness of their seclusion and restraint tested. Why there is no appeal is not explained in the explanatory memorandum. In the draft explanatory memorandum, which is not binding in accordance with the established Council of Europe practice, which, by the way, was new for me, only makes the precision that seclusion or restraint must never be used as a punishment for the mere convenience of staff because of staff shortages or to replace proper care or treatment. Then I come to Article 18 on treatment with the aim of producing irreversible effects. This article is even less protective, as it only covers treatment with the aim of producing irreversible physical effects. Any treatment with irreversible effects which are not physical, as well as any treatment which has irreversible side effects, since the irreversible effects are not the aim of the treatment, seems to be fine. The imprecise language defining the scope of mental disorder in the draft protocol could be interpreted to include a whole range of mental disorders, such as gender identity disorders, sleep disorders, sexual dysfunction. Okay, the DHBio recognizes that involuntary measures in this situation would never be appropriate. But the DHBio has still so far not integrated this text into the draft protocol itself. It is still in the not-binding explanatory memorandum. I also do not understand why the DHBio continues to use certain terms and definitions despite clear opposition from all relevant human rights mechanisms thereto, such as the term mental disorder, rather than psychosocial disabilities, or the definitions of a measure of involuntary only when a person with mental disorder objects to the measure, rather than defining a measure as involuntary as in other human rights instruments where the absence of free informed consent defines the involuntary measure, character of the measure. The opposition against the additional protocol reaches further than definitions and what is in the protocol or in the explanatory memorandum. So the committee recommended in the 2017 comments to integrate as a first step in the preamble of the draft additional protocol that involuntary measures are exceptional and used as a last resort. It is now in the preamble of this draft protocol, but this does not make the protocol more acceptable, because the protocol does not provide details, standards, or guidance about what the alternative to such measures should look like. Oops. The reason why we should oppose the additional protocol is fundamental. The aim of the additional protocol, a standard for protecting the right of people with psychosocial disability, already exists, in particular in the UN Convention of the Rights of Persons with Disability. The draft additional protocol weakens the protection that those standards provide. Adopting the additional protocol will risk an open conflict between international norms with the corresponding erosion of human rights. So I conclude, on the basis of the current version of the draft additional protocol submitted to the committee for comments, there is no reason to change the Assembly's assessment in 2016 that the drafting of the additional protocol should stop, and that the DHBO should instead focus its work on promoting alternatives to involuntary measures in psychiatric.
Thank you very, very much. Now, Mr. Xavier, you're here. The committee is opposed. And now, what is your position and the position of your Ministry for Health?
Okay. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. I'll be very brief because I'm sure that at least some of you are dreaming with lunch, so I'll be very brief. When the Ministry of Health asked me to come here, I think because of two situations. First, I'm leading the National Program for Mental Health in Portugal. And the second one, and I think more important, Portugal took a position against this protocol some months ago, and that's why I'm here, I think. So, just to give you a framework of the problem as we see it in Portugal, I will spend 5 minutes showing you a brief presentation just to stress some issues. And the point that I'd like to stress is that this is not a Portuguese problem. This is a problem of, as far as I know, each country in Europe. So if I have your attention, I'll give you a glimpse on the mental health legislation in Portugal. We have two specific legislations for mental health, one regarding general issues, the other regarding long-term structures, and then we have the usual legislation as you have in your countries, which is civil code, penal code, and the international conventions. And I stress here the role of CRPD. Okay? So the mental health legislation has two parts. It has 20 years, it has two parts. One, regulating the compulsory admission, and the other one is a conceptual approach of the way we organize mental health services. that is community approach. We launched this legislation 20 years ago. Now it's funny because we are relaunching the National Mental Health Plan, and we know that we have to revisit the legislation and probably change it. This is how we do compulsory admission in Portugal. Just to give you an appraisal, we start with an assessment in the emergency room, done by a psychiatrist, then the psychiatrist send an email to the court. The court notificates and confirms the admission. Then we have a second psychiatric assessment done by a different psychiatrist, and then we have a final decision. This is more or less the same in most European countries. We have strict regulation on rights of the patients, the usual thing that you may expect here. And if you ask me about how it's been done in Portugal in the last 20 years, I could say, not bad. We have the system fully implemented. The rate of compulsory admission in Portugal is about 10% of all mental admissions. We had some problems in the starting of the law, but not now. But we have a problem. And the problem, a challenge, was some years ago when Portugal ratified the CRPD. Because, as you know, the CRPD is, more specifically, the article number 14, is totally against of what was written in our mental health law. And the same applies to most European countries. The central contradiction, if I would choose one slide, it would be this slide. There is a problem between our mental health legislations and the Article 14, which is a contradiction on grounds of absolute ban on deprivation of liberty on the basis of impairments, physical or mental. So, on one side we have mental health legislation regulating compulsory admission. On the other side, most countries have ratified CRPD, in which there is a contradiction on the Article 14. And we've noticed, and we know that we have to make changes in our mental health law. Of course we have. Otherwise, we'll keep this contradiction in our legislation. And that's what I'm telling, that this is not just a Portuguese problem. This is a problem in every country. For instance, I just put here two wonderful papers, one done by George Schmuckler. Schmuckler is a psychiatrist that works in England, UK. He's a man with a long track record of working in community psychiatrists. He's very involved on the issue of human rights. And he wrote a wonderful paper stressing the contradictions between CRPD and Mental Health Act in England. And then we have another very important paper written by persons very linked with WHO mental health. Once again, based on this contradiction between legislations and the CRPD. Now, we are facing a bigger challenge, because if I make a synthesis in one slide, you may see that on the left you have the most important stakeholders. We have the population, we have the professionals, and we have legislation. On the other side, we have the country mental health laws, we have the CRPD, and then we have the Oviedo additional protocol. So, if we have, firstly, a problem between our laws and CRPD, we now have a second problem between the Oviedo additional protocol, the CRPD, and our country mental health laws. And this is a problem not only for Portugal. I'm afraid to say this, but as far as I know, and I would be very interesting if you may tell me that the situation is changed, as far as I know, every country in the European Union has regulations regarding compulsory admission. And I don't know, I'm not aware of any change made in last 4 or 5 years, including CRPD principles in mental health laws. So, to finalize, I think that there are issues to be in mind. First, there are a huge uncertainty in member states how to dismiss this conflict, this contradiction between law, CRPD, and conflict in the Oviedo Protocol. We agree as a country that this protocol is a shift from something that was in the road from the Green Paper in 2005, from the CRPD, which is the recovery approach. We think that this new additional protocol has just one article on alternative measures. In our opinion, this is the most important thing. And this is just one article. We also think, and I didn't wrote it, but comparing the version of 2015 and 2018, there are three articles, but the principles are the same. And we've seen no measures to involve what for us is more important, patients and family, in the issue of policy making. For instance, in Portugal, now we are starting a completely new approach for each piece of change in mental health organization. We call all the families and patients organizations and we discuss the proposals with them on a systematic way. That's why, for these reasons, that Portugal took a position against these protocols, not because we don't agree with the issue of human rights, but because there are a lot of things that are not included in protocol and that we think that should be. So that's, for in the first place, my general comment. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Xavier. Very, very clear words and underline what Mrs. De Bruin-Wesemann said. Yeah, absolutely. We have the chance for a question, Stella.
No? Yes. First of all, I want to thank Rainer De Bruin-Wesemann for an excellent presentation. And I want to thank you, sir, for a very brief, concise, but clear statement of where we stand. We have been trying to put across our concerns about this additional draft protocol for the last 2-3 years. Our concerns stem from the fact that it doesn't safeguard the rights of persons with psychosocial disabilities, but in fact there's a danger that it will create more discrimination against them and place them at a higher risk. And instead of moving towards stressing the importance of alternative care, we're trying to protect people with psychosocial disabilities by minimizing the risks of involuntary care. And I think this is the wrong way to go around. None of our concerns have been addressed. Reina has said this. Tanya, and I want to thank the secretariat of this committee, we put forward a very careful document over 2 years ago. None of our concerns have been addressed. And I wanted to know, and I think where we stand now, we need to understand what is the next step. If we believe that this additional protocol is fundamentally flawed and fundamentally violates the rights or could violate the rights of persons with psychosocial disability, what is the next step that we can make to make this position even more evident and heard? Because whatever we have done so far, and I support what you have said 100% and what you have said as well, sir, nothing has been included. None of our concerns have been included.
First, Rina made the proposal to make the preliminary draft comments available for the members of the Committee on Equality and Non-Discrimination. For that, I hope you all agree that we can make this available for them. That would be one of the next steps. And then, Tanya, I ask you, can you give Stella an answer? What is the next step? It's a political question, okay. Doreen, please. On the bottom, you have...
Thank you. Yeah, we're getting a bit confused here with all this technology. A very quick comment. First of all, I agree with everything that Rina and Stella have said, and I want to understand the next steps in all this, because it seems unsatisfactory to have these kind of concerns, which are so strong, and not addressed as quickly as we can. I'm really concerned about the issue of minors. Minors, M-I-N-O-R-S. As I understand it, they're not included in the protocol, and I really cannot imagine why, because we've had cases in the UK, and I had one 2 weeks ago, a bill going through, where a minor was actually restrained and died being restrained as a patient in the psychiatric unit. And I think minors, this issue should be clarified. Maybe Rena knows, I don't know. Do you know?
Oh, it says if it says at the beginning minors
are not, minors are not included in the additional protocol, but that's a reflection on the additional protocol. Maybe I can respond on what Stella brought in, and also at what Mr. Xavier told us. Thank you for the very brief sketch of the situation, because you're right, all parliaments, all states have legalization, just like you mentioned. And when I was at the DH Bio, one of the psychiatrists there even accused me from being dangerous, opposing the drafting of the protocol. So, to make it clear that a lot of people are wrestling by how to make the change from the human rights approach of mental health care. First, the situation where we are now, with the legislation with which you are, is not compatible with the UN, the CRPD protocol. In my report, I'm only acting to the draft additional protocol. And we try to get the DHBO in a position that please come with best practices and let us put those in place of involuntary measures. And there are years to go, I think, before we can make the change. But maybe, that's what I suggested to the committee, is besides of my report, maybe there must become a motion for working out a better mental health care service in the way as we see it. We expected the DHBO to do that, but when they don't, maybe we can put something in place of that. Maybe that's the way to go further. That's not what we have decided here today, but it's just coming up with me. But just because Mr. Xavier made it very clear where the tension is on this dossier, so maybe I can do that suggestion to the committee.
Last intervention, Stella, because I have to look a little bit on the time.
I just wanted to thank Mr. Xavier again for what he pointed out, because when he actually put it up, it suddenly became even more clear that in many of our countries, our mental health laws are contradicting the convention. And whereas we should be trying to change those laws in order to follow the convention, this is now coming in the opposite direction. And I think that this is the danger. So we really are, even in our at a national level, in a very difficult situation now with this.
Please, Chris.
Just a final comment. If you ask me to synthesize all of this, I would say that, in my opinion, and this is not the Portuguese opinion, it's my opinion as an expert, as a professor of psychiatry and so on. I think that the document is totally useless. Why so? For two reasons. First one, all the issues regarding rights are already in our mental health laws. All the things that are related with the new approaches are absent. So the document is useless, in my opinion. That's all.
Please, you can... 1 minute, please.
No, 1 minute.
I see in your face that you...
I agree with the term useless, but... But adapting it, it will be very dangerous because it's going the opposite position. There's even something that is usual can give a very wrong signal. So that's why I propose to getting to oppose this the additional protocol.
Okay, thanks for the debate. And Raina, maybe your last proposal we have to think about in the committee. To make an official motion of the committee. I think that is interesting. Now my job is to thank you, to thank Monsieur Xavier, and in the name of Mrs. Ana Mendes, the head of the Portuguese delegation to the Council of Europe Parliamentary Assembly, we are now invited for a lunch. And the lunch is inside the building. It's the old lunch room of the former monastery, I think. Okay, so we have now time. Thanks for the debate. Thank to the interpreter that you are so nice, and I will think overnight how I can be nice to you tomorrow.